that's not so important, particularly not to the Russians. They're really not obsessed with territory. What is the crux of the issue is whether the government in Kiev is going to be Western aligned, or if it's going to be to pivot back to Russia and be Moscow aligned. That is the key to everything. And so I suspect.
Alex Craner, good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Andy. Good to join you again, and greetings to all your viewers and listeners.
It's always great to have you on, and just great insight. I'm really looking forward to this. So let's start with what happened with the whole Alaskan meeting with Trump and Putin, and then let's weave that in into what are the implications here, and potentially, if we have the time, what it means for Europe.
Well, I think it's really, really momentous development. I think one thing that is kind of emerging from the insights, from the analysis, from even from what wasn't said or people who didn't turn up at the meeting, it seems to me that Ukraine was maybe a side issue in Alaska, that much, much bigger things were being discussed, because, you know, nobody on Trump's delegation was particularly a Ukraine-Russia expert. And the one person, his name escapes me now, one of the very important Russian officials who was in charge of the negotiations with the Ukrainians, he wasn't at the meeting either, you know, so he would be the point man if Ukraine was the central issue. And I assume that he would have been there if that was the, you know, the main thing at the event, but he wasn't. And so it's, I think that the Trump delegation and the Putin delegation, they were discussing the future of development between the two powers. And, you know, let's recall your viewers that this is, you know, the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, between Russia and the United States, is far and away the most important bilateral relationship in the world, that is practically determining the future of development of humanity and the future of peace. And that's how it's been perceived for well over a century now. And one of the ways in which American and Russian officials since 1864, pretty much that we know of, have thought about those development is to bring the two countries together where they share a border, which is, you know, between Alaska and the Chukotka Peninsula. And they were intending to drill a tunnel to connect the two countries physically. I always want to say the wrong name, but FDR's vice president, Wallace, Henry Wallace, he was discussing this with Joseph Stalin as a development. And so back then, you know, that was right after World War II, the two nations were once more allies, which they have been for the duration of the 19th century, except that was then derailed by Winston Churchill and his government. And now we see that the same networks of power are trying to derail the positive relationship between Russia and United States once more. And that's always, you know, the London-Paris axis of the former and current European colonialist powers, Britain and France, along with their, you know, allies in Europe, like in today's circumstances, that would be, you know, Germany and Sweden and Finland and Poland and so forth. And so they're horrified, but I think that both the Russians and the Americans understand the importance of their relationship, and they see huge potential in developing those relationships. You know, the United States is one of the world's leading economies and industrial powers. or it can be again, as it was once. It's one of the world's leading technological superpowers. And Russia is catching up there. And also Russia has an estimated $75 to $90 trillion in natural resource wealth that remains largely undeveloped. So, you know, the potential to for economic development, for prosperity, for, you know, mutually beneficial relations of all kinds to emerge, to be cultivated between the United States and Russia are absolutely enormous. Whereas, you know, the war path in Ukraine, you know, the United States kind of supporting the European project Ukraine, it's all downside. It's all downside with the risk of triggering a nuclear holocaust. So I think that's what Alaska was about. And I think that that's what post-Alaska is about. And I think that we're going to see more and more developments in this sphere. We just saw last week that Tulsi Gabbard prohibited United States intelligence agencies from sharing intelligence about the discussion between the United States and Russia with the Five Eyes, meaning, you know, the intelligence networks of Great Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And so that's a very, very radical move. And I think that that's practically a total discontinuity from the default policies of the United States after 1946, because the United States has been very, very firmly, fully and completely in the orbit of the British Empire and the European power, European powers. And, you know, by the way, British Empire is still a thing. It's not, it didn't go anywhere. It has a different reincarnation now. It's tried to make itself invisible, but it's still pretty much a thing. And, you know, it's always been dependent since the end of World War II on the United States to be its funding and military enforcement department.
It goes with everything you just said, with that the meeting was in Alaska and it was only Putin and Trump. And then it was very telling too that everybody else, the EU, the powers that be in the EU, as well as Zelensky, they all went to the White House, correct me if I'm wrong. So it wasn't even in Alaska.
Yeah. Trump pretty much summoned them there, like a bunch of kids to the principal's office. And that's what the whole thing looked like. And I found amazing was that the body language was very, very telling. And the surprising part of it is that I you know, it was the European leaders who looked like they saw death. And Zelensky, for his part, he was kind of chipper. He was relaxed. He was almost cheerful. And I thought, you know, what must have happened is that, you know, Trump and Putin must have decided in Alaska, let's let Zelensky slide out of this one, you know, and probably Trump offered him a golden parachute in some form. And so he's probably going to be out of the picture very soon, because he's also, you know, since May of last year, he hasn't been the legitimate president of Ukraine because he didn't stand for elections. And I think that the United States and Russia are both going to demand new elections for Ukraine, because there has to be a legitimate leader to sign on any treaty that's going to be concluded between Russia and Ukraine. And I wouldn't be surprised if that new leader turns out to be Valery Zaluzhny. And it seems to me that Zaluzhny's candidacy has come to the fore pretty much since Trump took over at the White House, because I think that London and the Biden administration were not so keen on Zaluzhny. I think that they were more looking to, you know, maybe Petro Poroshenko, or maybe somebody like the former gas princess. She used to be the prime minister of Ukraine back in the, you know, about 15 years ago or so, someone like that. And now suddenly, you know, you have the Vogue or GQ have a photo shoot with the Zaluzhny, and the British are now very keen on providing help and assistance to Ukraine to conduct, you know, fair and transparent elections, which means that they are probably very, very afraid that the government might fall into the wrong hands. And you know, this is actually the crux of the issue. It's not, you know, in the West, there's this obsession with maps and with colors on the maps, who took how much territory. That's not so important, particularly not to the Russians. They're really not obsessed with territory. What is the crux of the issue is whether the government in Kiev is going to be Western aligned, or if it's going to be to pivot back to Russia and be Moscow aligned. That is the key to everything. And so I suspect that if Valery Zaluzhny wins the election, that ultimately in the end, the government in Kiev is going to pivot back to the Russian orbit. And then, you know, the defeat of the West is in Ukraine is complete. So we're going to see, but it seems to me that things are moving in this direction. And I think that Trump is okay with that because trying to control Russia and bring it into the Western fold by force and against the wishes of the Russian people, and even against the wishes of a significant part of Ukrainian people who might want to be part of the EU but might not want to be part of the NATO, it's difficult, it's expensive, and it always is, it comes with the risk of World War III, which the United States doesn't want, unlike, you know, European colonial powers who do want World War III.
Yeah, so this really goes well with a discussion I had with our friend Tom Luongo, Gold, Goats, and Guns. And he made, this was about 6 months ago, he sees Russia being the guarantor of really the continent, the European continent. Work that out for me. Do you see that happening? And yeah, just talk about that.
Are you saying Russia being the guarantor or United States being the guarantor?
Russia being the guarantor of the European continent. Like you said in the past in previous discussions, Germany going east to Russia.
Oh, right. Okay. So yeah, but that's a different timeline. Let's say a longer cycle of history. I think that in the end, Germany pivots back to Russia because always after these horrible crises of war and depression and hyperinflation, Germany has had a tendency to pivot back to Russia as a strategic regional partner in Eastern Europe. And, you know, the reason is because, you know, Germany has been an industrial power, a productive economy based on engineering and producing advanced finished products and so on, whereas Russia has been traditionally an exporter of raw commodities. And so that partnership works. And I think that in the long cycle of history, that's going to come to fruition again, not under the current government, you know, the CDU and the Chancellor Merz, who is through and through a BlackRock man, but it's going to happen when his government is overthrown, and in the case that AfD takes power, the alternative for Germany, which, you know, which is the another sovereigntist movement like many that are emerging now in Europe, in Slovakia and in Poland, in Hungary, Croatia as well, and Romania. It's coming from the bottom up. The EU is trying to kind of manage the democracy and cancel it if necessary to prevent these movements from taking political power. But I think that's only a matter of time because the EU is no longer viable. The Trump administration is openly supportive of the sovereigntist movement in individual countries like Marine Le Pen in France, like AfD in Germany and so forth, like Viktor Orban in Hungary. And so I think that little by little, individual European countries are going to be pivoting. It's not just pivoting to Russia, it's pivoting to the multipolar integrations, to the BRICS organization, to the Belt and Road initiative that's being pushed forward by China and Russia and India and so forth. And so these are processes that are drawing more and more nations in, because it's looking to peaceful cooperation and economic development and buildup of prosperity and lifting people out of poverty, whereas the London-Paris axis, all their pitching is war and more war and more war and infinite forever war, wars for gains that are only for the European oligarchic families, not for everybody else. So I think that it's the time for those, for that political platform is now over. And I think that something completely different is going to take its place. So we're looking at a discontinuity with pretty much 500 years of European history. And hopefully we will avoid another big war on the continent in the process.
Yes, well said. In fact, I laugh not at you, but I just think about that 500 years of what the EU was, or European continent was, more or less coming to an end, but it was. And that really into our previous talks when you discussed about the implosion really of the UK. It seems like that is happening right now. Correct me if I'm wrong. And also Germany, and how they really, Western Europe doesn't have any natural resources. They only have war.
Yes, that's correct. So the British economy is coming apart at the seams, it seems. The unemployment is rising. Inflation just hit 3.6%, consumer price index. The Bank of England has projected that within the end of the year, it's going to hit at least 3.75%. So it means it's probably going to be higher. Unemployment is rising. In the last 12 months, I think something is like 135,000 people in the UK lost their jobs. And it seems that trend is accelerating because 81,000 of those 135,000 lost their jobs just in the last few months. And then unconfirmed data to be verified is that just in the month of June, 41,000 people lost their jobs. And this is, if we go back to October last year, when the Starmer government brought out and published their much anticipated annual budget, and they were just going gung-ho with, economic development, increased taxing, increased borrowing, increased government investment and spending, on all the wrong thing. They're investing in war. They're investing in cockamamie projects like these multi-billion-dollar industrial facilities to capture carbon from the atmosphere and store it underground. I mean, who ever asked for that? Nobody asked for it. It's just like complete insanity. And then covering thousands of acres of like premium pastures with solar panel. And then on top of that, funding a project to dim the sun.
It's absurd.
It's almost as though the lunatics, the asylum has taken over, They've taken over the asylum, and the country is being deliberately destroyed. I can't think that it's not deliberate, because it's so incredibly insane. that I have a hard time thinking that this is just, incompetence or, errors, you know. They're all laboring under this Project Net Zero, you know, that they formulated a couple of years ago where, you know, they want to phase out air travel. They want to phase out consumption of red meat. So they really are trying to destroy production of lamb and beef. Complete and total war on farmers. You know, once upon a time in the UK, for example, you would have to register your chickens if you had 50 or more. Today, if you have one single solitary chicken, you have to register it with the government. Why? You know, because chickens are very useful. You know, you can eat their meat, you can get eggs from them and so forth. And it doesn't seem that government want people to have any kind of self-sufficiency, that they can't help themselves in any way. So they want to know where every last chicken is so that they can, you know, call them if need be. And so I don't see where that goes except into the complete collapse and the bankruptcy. And today we do see an acceleration and escalation of social uprisings in England, in the UK. And it was like maybe just a few months ago or about a year ago where Professor David Bates, I think he's on King's College or in Oxford, I forget which university, but he's a very, very well thought of professor who studies things like social uprising and civil war as his, you know, core competency. And he said that, you know, the United Kingdom and pretty much the whole rest of Europe are not only likely to slip into civil wars, but they are, his words, explosively configured for a civil war to break out. And I think that we might be looking at that actually starting to happen in the UK. And then I think France and Germany might not be far behind.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that too. And I mean this as from a person, my comment is, and I am a pro-immigration. I'm married to an Eastern European immigrant. I think people should be able to come and go as they please. That being said, what they've done or what we've done here in the U.S. is not the right process, if you would. And there's certainly, that's just a whole nother conversation. But UK and really all of Europe, they have a huge immigration problem. Again, I say that I'm pro-immigration. And what's hard, our friend Doug Casey, I remember reading, he had this comment, the most dangerous thing in the world is a young 20-year-old male with nothing to do and no hope. And it seems like you have that now, not only in the UK, but really through Western Europe with all of this influx of immigration, just young people, young men with no hope and no identity. And just imagine if they get their hands on, you know, a firearm or a knife, even the kind of violence that would bring upon.
Well, yes. And this is very much being done deliberately, you know,
right.
Because this is exactly the kind of dry tinder that the people in power rely on when they want to orchestrate a war or social uprisings, because social uprisings give them a justification to clamp down and to introduce whatever measures they want in order to you know, put the populations in ghettos, concentration camps, whatever they want. They can say like, emergency civil war uprisings. We have to shut everybody down in 15-minute cities. Nobody can go out. It's too dangerous. It's too risky. Government will take care of you. We'll introduce digital IDs so we know where everybody is. Everybody's comings and goings. Everybody has to give up cash because that's how the criminals finance themselves. We're going to introduce CBDCs, and then everyone will live happily forever after. But, you know, these are not random events. These are deliberately orchestrated events. And even these immigrants, you know, they're not necessarily violent thugs, every single last one of them. But, you know, if you have 1,000 immigrants with nothing to do, it's going to be easy to find 10 if you give them like $100 and tell them, go there and stage a provocation. And they'll do it. They have nothing to do, you know. And you know, turn some money to get ahead somehow, they will do what is being asked of them. And so this, you know, it's very important to keep in mind that this is being done deliberately, and that the provocations that are happening as we speak are done deliberately to bait us into some kind of reaction that will justify a government clampdown. And so I think that it's very important for us to keep that in mind and to try to avoid falling into those provocations and giving the government what they want to begin with. I see this happening now in Croatia and in Bosnia. You know, it's becoming very obvious where you have like a Wahhabi Muslim organization. They are sending these women in black burqas to Croatian towns and villages, and then they start praying in a public place in front of everybody, and they're waiting for an incident to happen. And then, you know, so what happened is that some local guy walked up to this woman praying on the floor, on the ground in a public place, and told her to go away. And somebody took a video of this. And then the next thing that happened is some jihadi leader in Bosnia said, "Oh, this is an affront. We're going to bring 1,000 male, you know, Wahhabi jihadis to this village to stage a prayer to a village that is 100% Croatian." And this was stopped by the Bosnian authorities, but then it emerged that it was funded from Serbia, which makes no sense whatsoever. Like, there's no reason for the Serbs to do this kind of thing and provoke the Croats. Yeah. But, you know, both Serbia and Croatia and Bosnia are chock full of Western-funded NGOs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can find a Croatian NGO that funds anti-Vucic protests in Serbia, which has happened. And then you have Serbian NGOs, which fund these Muslim jihadi, Wahhabi sects to go and provoke people in Bosnian parts of Croatia and so on. And so this all goes back to that metaphor, you know, of sticking black and red ants into a jar and then shaking it up, and then the ants start killing themselves, but they don't, you know, because they can only see the other. They don't see that somebody shook up the jar. And so this is now happening, and it's happening all over the place. And it, strangely enough, there's a researcher whose name I forget now, but she's an authority on these jihadist movements, you know. And she said that it's the government of Britain who is trying to displace the United States as a global hegemon and to take over world global dominance by leveraging all these Muslim jihadi organizations. And then, you know, as it happens, all of these immigrants, to take the story back to migrations, something like 85% of all migrants in the world are all Muslim. Isn't that interesting?
That's interesting. Yeah.
So it does seem that it's some kind of very well planned scheme. It remains to be seen whether it's going to be successful. But you know, it's a lot easier to stage arson attacks against peace than to fight the fires.
Yeah. So, last question, and we'll end on this because I know you got to go. But if you could talk about how does the Middle East, what's their role in all this, or what's going on with that? And I mean that because Trump was just over in Saudi at the beginning of the summer. We just had this meeting with Putin. It seems like the Trump administration is trying to, again, build bridges and make alliances. But yeah, comment a little bit on the Middle East and where does this fit in all of this plans, both in the EU and Trump, and with Trump?
Yeah, I think that the Middle East is, again, the region where the, you know, the Western empire, the globalists are trying to stir the pot to cause an escalation to World War III, or, you know, some kind of a wider regional war that's going to, again, be able to draw in Iran and Russia and destabilize them and weaken them in that way. And as always, the provocations and the destabilization is the job of the state of Israel. And that's what Israel has been created for, exactly. So, you know, I think we have to do away with the notion that, oh, you know, Israel was set up as a homeland for the Jews where they could be safe and so on. I think that Israel has been set up as an imperial outpost, as a beachhead to destabilize the Middle East on a perpetual basis. And that the Jews are just being cynically used as cannon fodder in these projects. Always. They're always at war with somebody, and they're paying the price. It's not like this is some kind of a wonderful privilege that they have. They're being used there precisely as cannon fodder, even though, you know, it's much easier to see the carnage that they themselves have inflicted on the Palestinians. And so, you know, now it seems that we're going into another escalation between Israel and Iran. At the same time, it seems that Israel is on a collision course with Turkey, and which is pretty much seems irreversible. And it's not just Syria. It's also Cyprus. Another front that's emerging is Cyprus, because the Turks are very, very concerned about Israelis who are increasingly coming to Cyprus as migrants, and who have been buying large amounts of properties and land in Cyprus, not just on the Greek side, but also on the Turkish side. And so the Turks have upgraded Cyprus as a national security priority now. And they are boosting their troop presence there from the current 40,000 troops to more than 100,000 troops. At the same time, the Western powers, primarily Britain and Israel as well, are helping Greece get armed to their teeth. You know, at the same time when other NATO countries are complaining about having to boost their defense spending, you know, to 2% of the GDP and then higher over the next God knows how many years, to 5%. The Greece is already at 3.8%. They're upgrading their military in a very massive way. They're buying Air Force, anti-aircraft defense. They're building submarines. And all of it is being done in preparation for a showdown against Turkey. And so the situation is, you know, being rigged for a major outbreak of war. And then, you know, Turkey has like some form of a defense pact with Albania and with Macedonia, which is north of, you know, former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia, which is north of Greece. And then, you know, for some odd, mysterious reason, there's been recently a military pact signed between Croatia, Albania, and Bulgaria, which is obviously targeted against Serbia. And then, you know, the Brits signed a military cooperation agreement with Bosnia in February of this year. So, you know, it seems to me that they are carefully and slowly rigging the whole region of the Middle East and then the Balkans, so they could bring the war into continental Europe for some kind of a major war escalation that could happen, maybe not tomorrow, but it could start to escalate over the coming months towards the end of this year. But we'll see. The showdown between Iran and Israel could actually be quite imminent. It could happen in the next week.
Gosh, I hope you're wrong. That's all I
do too. Yes,
I know. I hope you're wrong. Alex, you got to go here, but I want you to give your websites or your Substacks here. And I want to tell all my viewers, again, I don't mean to embarrass you, Alex, but I got to say this on record. Alex is probably my favorite and my go-to guy on geopolitics. You're not going to get a better analyst than that. And I think that's also with many of my guests have said the same thing, both online in my interviews with them, as well as offline. As well as Alex is not only a fantastic mind and has his thumb on the pulse, especially in Europe, but he's incredibly gracious with his time. So I want to thank you for that. But go ahead and give me your Substack and I'll put all of this in the show.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you. That's very kind of you. So readers can find me on Substack. I have two publications. One of them is a daily trend following newsletters for traders and investors. It's called iSystem Trend Compass. The other one is my personal publication called Alex Craner's Substack. And I'm also quite active on X. My handle is @NakedHedgy. And then from there, you can find other platforms, but this is where I'm most active.
Yeah, I'll put all of this in the show notes, and I want to be very respectful of your time. Thank you so much, Alex, for your time.
Thank you very much, Andy. Take care. And again, warm greetings to your viewers and listeners.
Yeah, be safe, okay?
Yeah.